The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral W. Peach presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Meredith and Judge Falvey. We are convened today via televideo video conference to consider arguments in the matter of Lewis R. Page versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 19-865. Will counsel, beginning with the appellate's counsel, please make your appearance for the record.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Melissa Hendricks, and with Tom Paulsino, we are from Bergwin and Moore and are representing appellant Lewis R. Page in this matter.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary's counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Spencer Horseman on behalf of appellee Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and I'm joined by Anna Whited, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Thank you. And does the appellate's counsel wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay, thank you. If counsel are ready, let's begin with appellate's counsel. Ms. Hendricks, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Judge Peach, Judge Meredith, and Judge Falvey. And may it please the court. The case before you today is about the secretary appending to his brief fee basis VA treatment records that it intentionally chose not to allow the board to have access to at the time the board rendered its decision, and then asking this court to make an initial factual finding that these records the board never saw are not relevant, to find an undisputable duty to assist error not prejudicial. 38 U.S.C. section 7261 makes clear that the court is prohibited from making factual findings in the first instance. As the Federal Circuit held in Kine, if this court makes an independent finding of fact absent an underlying factual finding by the board, this court exceeds its jurisdiction to review the board's decision and impermissibly engages in first instance fact finding barred by 7261. This principle was reiterated in two recent Federal Circuit decisions. The first is Tadlock. In Tadlock, the Federal Circuit, when discussing the rules of prejudicial error and citing to the Supreme Court decision in Camp versus Pitts, stated that prejudicial error review is limited to the administrative record already in existence, not some new record made initially in the reviewing court. The Federal Circuit then held that the Veterans Court jurisdiction to consider prejudicial error does not give it the right to make de novo findings of fact or otherwise resolve matters that are open to debate. In Eusebio, the Federal Circuit reiterated that in Kine, it had explained that the Veterans Court may not rely on extra record evidence to make a finding of fact in the first instance. Here, if the court accepts the Secretary's position, it will first have to make an initial factual finding that all of the records at issue have been appended to the secretary's brief and made part of the record. This is similar to the facts in Kine, where the Federal Circuit held that the Veterans Court had improperly considered affidavits proffered by the VA that had been created specifically for the record before the court because they were evidentiary in nature. It's important to note that in Mr. Page's case, all of the records cited to in his principal brief were not appended to the secretary's brief. For instance, he cited a scanned fee basis records from January 2015, yet those records were not originally included in the records appended to the secretary's brief. While the secretary attempted to get them into the record only a few days before this argument, it still raises the question of whether all the records are in there, and when the process of appending more and more records would end in each of these cases. Additionally, it's impossible to know if all of the May 2018 fee basis records have been appended to the secretary's brief, because if you look at them, they're all jumbled, there's letters on top of each other, and they're hard to comprehend. And those are located at Exhibit B5 appended to the secretary's brief. Second, the secretary's position that the court look at the records appended to his brief and determine the board's failure to obtain them as harmless error is contrary to the board's duty to assist obligation under 38 CFR 3.159C3. Pursuant to this regulatory obligation, as Sullivan and Jones make clear, the board is obligated to obtain the records of non-VA treatment authorized by VA, regardless of their relevance. Thus, what the secretary is asking the court to do is to allow a higher burden in court than the veteran has before the board. And notably, the practical
Hendricks. Hi, Judge Falvey. Were these records of VA authorized medical treatment? The secretary seems to dispute that and say, no, this was not VA authorized. And one of the documents they provided as an exhibit, I guess, to their motion is a document submitted by Mr. Page that is titled VA authorized records or a request for them.
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to, I think that was, it was in February 2018 and it was a claim to have VA authorize his treatment, I believe at the Jefferson Hospital, which was the treatment from January 31st, 2018 to early February 2018. It's our position that, these are fee basis treatment records for a few reasons.
Hold on though. The regulation uses the language VA authorized medical treatment. And here's a form that's claim for payment of unauthorized medical services. It doesn't use fee based, and the secretary seems to dispute your understanding of what fee based means. My question to you is, were these VA authorized medical treatment? And if not, don't we have to turn to the second part of that, and relevance does become a question for other non-VA authorized medical treatment?
Sure. So I think at a minimum, what the secretary has pointed out is that there's at least some ambiguity as to whether these are authorized VA treatment. Like you said, we're interpreting fee, when VHA labels something as fee basis in their treatment records, we're interpreting that as it means that the treatment was authorized.
I don't think they've conceded or would agree that these were fee-based medical treatment, but rather they dispute your understanding of what it means when the record says that there's some documents that relate to fee basis.
Sure. So I guess my point is that there's at least at a minimum ambiguity as to
did the secretary authorize this medical treatment?
We're arguing that they were labeled as fee basis, and so yes.
Well, but did they? Did they authorize it?
Well, I can't definitively say that. What I can say is that to ask the court to determine when there's ambiguity, whether the treatment records were authorized for VA treatment would also be a factual finding that the court would have to make in the first instance, which as I'm arguing that this court cannot do. And to your second point, if you have something else?
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say to your second point, even if the records aren't fee basis, it would still, the board would still have a duty to assist obligation to obtain them as private treatment records that would have to be relevant. But as we argued in our principal brief, a veteran like Mr. Page, who has a significant mental illness, whenever he would go in for a hospitalization, it is safe to assume that they would ask him questions about his psychiatric treatment. And so, these records would be relevant. There would still be a duty to assist obligation. And for the secretary to now append the records to his brief and ask the court to make the determination of whether they're relevant now would also be an initial finding of fact. And then just to wrap up that point is that in this case, in Mr. Page's case, while the secretary argues that there's nothing in the treatment records that is relevant, We believe that there is. There's records, and I can give you the citations, that show symptoms of hallucinations, refusing meds and fluids, paranoia about medical intervention, that when Mr. Page arrived for his hospitalization for his stroke, he was just disheveled and his mood was angry, all of which are not definitively linked, as the secretary suggests, to his stroke or dehydration.
Judge Falvey, could I jump in there, or you still have more questions?
Oh, go right ahead.
So I wanted to follow up first on a point you just made, and it's impossible to know if there are other records. Is the appellant contending that there are more, we'll just call them fee basis records, from 2015 or 2018 that were not appended to either of the secretary's motions to amend the RBA? Are you saying there are in fact other records that are out there that the court is unaware of at this point?
I think it's the point is just that we don't know, especially because, like I said, the May 2018 records that were appended, you really can't read them. So we're not sure if they're complete or not. But I think the greater point was just that if there's ambiguity about it, then the court would have to make that initial factual finding.
Judge Fowles just mentioned that those 2018 records were actually submitted by the appellant to VA. So is it your position that the appellant does not know whether all of those records are now before the court in the form of this appendix to the secretary's motion to amend the RBA?
Sure. Well, I think I'm not exactly sure what Mr. Page was thinking, and that's not necessarily our position. But I think the point is that because there is a duty to assist obligation before the board, the veteran, he believed that all of his VA treatment records had been considered when the board rendered its decision. And so it's deprived him, you know, even if he says, oh, those were all the records, well, it still deprived him of an opportunity to respond to the records, you know, which he could have done if the board had obtained them and then an SOC or an SSOC had been issued. He could have said, well, my doctor told me that these psychiatric symptoms were related to my service-connected PTSD, yet it wasn't documented in the records.
So let me change gears a little bit on you. I want to talk about prejudice or harm. As you know, under Sanders v. Shinseki, the Supreme Court has said that it's the appellant's burden to show that a VA error caused him harm in some fashion. In your opening briefs, I don't believe you mentioned what you just did about in the content of these disputed records. Under Sanders, regardless of what the court can do in terms of looking at the records, what's the appellant's burden? Do you have to come forward with a showing or at least an explanation of how these disputed records could have made some difference in the board's determination that a 100% rating was not warranted?
Sure. So two points of that is that, again, it's our position that these were fee basis authorized VA treatment. And so the veteran, because of 3.159C3 and Sullivan, that doesn't require relevance for these records. I don't think that the appellant, we would have a burden to show that they were relevant in order for them to have to be obtained.
You're talking about whether there's a duty to assist error. I'm talking about whether an error, assuming there's a duty to assist error, how was the appellant harmed by it? And does the appellant under Sanders have some obligation to explain to the court how he was harmed by VA's failure to consider the disputed records?
Sure. Well, I think as I pointed out, especially in this case, if you do look at the records, they do contain relevant information. And so I guess I'm not sure, I'm not exactly sure how to answer your question, but.
So I'll put it more concretely for you. In a decision on appeal, the board found that the appellant is not entitled to a 100% scheduler rating because he's not totally occupationally and socially impaired. And part of the reason, I think a pivotal reason, was that They found no total social impairment because the veteran has been in a long-term relationship with his significant other and is close with her family and others. So in order to show that the appellant was harmed by failure to consider these disputed records, does he not have some obligation to show that these records could undermine that finding that he is not totally socially impaired due to his PTSD?
Well, so if the court chooses to look at the records, then I suppose that he, you know, if that's the route, if accepting the secretary's position, then we would have to show, if we're not saying that they're fee basis records, then we would have to show that there's some sort of relevance. But if you look at the records, like I said, there's hallucinations and disheveled appearance, which are both symptoms that are listed in the 100% rating criteria under Diagnostic Code 9411.
So you've seen the records, the 2015, the 2018 records. I'll just ask you directly, is there anything in there that shows that potentially could show that PTSD causes total social impairment?
I think that arguably based on those symptoms, yes, and that the board would have to consider the evidence in the first instance and make that factual finding.
And so to what extent should we take into account that the initial briefing did not in any way talk about what symptoms could potentially have been found in these records? I believe in the briefing, it was more hypotheticals about if certain symptoms are shown or if these records showed a worsening, it might have an impact. I believe this is the first time you're talking about the content of the disputed records.
Right. So I think in general, it's just part of our argument that it was the board's duty to assist obligation to get the records because they were, before we looked at them, they were potentially relevant because, like I think I mentioned before, you know, whenever you have a patient who has a significant mental illness, like 70% service-connected PTSD, in a hospitalization, it will usually contain evidence of them talking about his psychiatric evaluation. And so, you know, I think it just stems from our argument that you know, these records are either don't have to be relevant, but the board still has to obtain them, or they were potentially relevant and the board would still have to obtain them.
Let me ask you one more question along these lines. You mentioned Tadlock earlier, which holds that this court can't make de novo factual findings even in the prejudicial error context when the question is open to debate. But is there anything in Tadlock that prevents this court from saying the appellant didn't meet his pleading burden of explaining how he was harmed by the alleged errors, as opposed to finding as a fact what may or may not be in those records?
I guess the only thing I can point to in Tadlock is the holding that, you know, prejudicial error doesn't give the Veterans Court the right to resolve matters that are open to debate. And I guess the argument is that, you know, as we're talking about, you know, whether the records are relevant or not, whether they're fee basis or not, I mean, that is a question that's open to debate. Those are going to be factual findings. So I don't.
But I'm talking about a pleading requirement, not the factual basis for your arguments. Does Tadlock say we can't look to Sanders and say it was your burden to prove harm and you didn't attempt to do that?
I'm not exactly sure. I can try to answer that question in my rebuttal time if that's okay.
I just wanted to follow up on one other point. Sorry, Judge Peach, did you want to jump in there?
I was going to, but go ahead, finish up.
I was going to change topics, so I'll defer to you.
Okay. I see we have 1 minute and 35 seconds. Let me ask a couple of questions here, and then We can add some more time if possible, Greg. With respect to the records, can you explain, can you talk to whether they were constructively in the file or not?
Sure, so we are not disputing that the board had constructive possession of the treatment records identified in the brief. What we are contesting, our argument, is that while these records were constructively possessed by the board, that they can't be made part of the record before this court. And the reason is that we are distinguishing this case, particularly from Bell, because, you know, this case involves treatment records that were scanned into VA's Vista imaging system. They were never reviewed by the board. And it raises a question of fundamental fairness, which is why should treatment records become part of the record before the court when the secretary made an affirmative decision that they not be part of the record before the board? So, you know, it's like the secretary wants to have it both ways. He doesn't want the board to see these records when adjudicating the claim, but if and only if a veteran avails himself of his appellate rights in court, then wants them to be made available.
So you're saying that the records were constructively possessed by the board?
Correct. We're not contesting that point. Just but, that doesn't mean that they can be made part of the record before this court.
Okay, but they're not part of the record then, though, is what you're saying.
That right, the record.
Possessed by the board, possessed by the board, but not made part of the record.
Before the court, yes.
Judge Meredith, did you have some extra questions?
I wanted to ask you about your second argument having to do with the heightened duty to assist and that the loss of the veterans claims file may have required VA to obtain a new exam without evidence that the condition had worsened. Can you give us an idea of why you believe, based on your review of the record and your discussions with the veteran, why VA's attempt to recreate the record may not have captured all of the records that were lost?
Sure, so in this case specifically, there was a period from 2015 to 2017 where there was no claims file, yet the last VA examination was in November 2015. And so basically the argument is that if VA loses a veteran's records for 2 years, there's no way for the adjudicator to know whether the examination from 2015 is fully contemporaneous. You know, when they lose the claims file, how is the board supposed to know if a veteran alleged worsening or not? And also in the time between when they lost Mr. Page's claims file and rebuilt it, they never notified him that one of the blanks to fill out was whether his condition had worsened. So that's our position on that.
Do you have a basis for alleging that there may be additional records out there? Those or anything in your review of the claims file that suggests anomalies that lead you to believe not all of the records have been recaptured into the system?
Yeah, I think that we just one second cited to it in our brief.
The incomplete application to TDIU.
Yeah, I believe that there was when they were saying that they rebuilt the file, there was something in there that indicated that there could have been something missing, like you said, related to TDIU, which, you know, again raises you know, ambiguity as to whether we can't know if the claims file was complete at that point. Our argument is just that the board can't know if an examination is fully contemporaneous in this specific case if we don't know necessarily whether everything was put back into the claims file that was lost for those 2 years.
Again, as to prejudice, does the appellant have some obligation to contend or explain why there may be records out there that weren't reobtained that could show worsening. Has he told his doctors that he got worse? Does he have an obligation to tell us why there are missing records and why they might help in his case?
Well, I think that to do that before this court would be extra record evidence that
under Sanders, there's a duty to explain to the court why you were believe the appellant was harmed. That's the test I'm referring to.
Sure. So I think that the argument is that we don't know if the claims file was properly rebuilt. Mr. Page was never put on notice before the board that if there was a hole that needed to be filled, it could be whether he had a worsening condition or not, because his claims file was lost in the time period after he had his last VA examination.
Was he involved with recreating the claims file? Was he asked to submit alternate documents along those lines?
I'm not sure about that.
You have any questions, Judge Falvey?
Just a couple. I think you made the point in your reply brief that you were still contesting the 70% rating before 2015, I guess it is. What's the board error with respect to that?
So the period prior to November 2015?
Right.
So that would be that the records, when there was the January 2015 records that were arguing that the board had a duty to obtain, which could be determinative of that period, as well as any records after that could still, you know, talk about the severity of his symptoms.
The 2018 fee-based treatment?
The January 2015, yes.
Right, okay. Secondly, regarding the constructive possession, if you've conceded that these records were constructively possessed by the board, how do you square your position with Eusebio, where the Federal Circuit said constructive possession is a remedy for duty to assist violations? If the remedy is to say, oh, but we constructively possessed the documents, does it still necessitate a remand then? If it's a remedy, it strikes me that it's an argument for not sending it back.
So my understanding of Eusebio was in that case, the court said that the Veterans Court can take judicial notice of extra record evidence that's generally known. But then it also found that the question of whether the board constructively possessed that NAS report, that was a question for the court, but whether the NAS report was sufficient to satisfy McClendon was something that the board needed to talk about, because that was an initial factual determination. So I guess it's our position that Eusebio still talks about the fact that the Veterans Court can't make factual determinations in the first instance. So while the board could have constructively possessed these treatment records, to ask the court to say that they're not relevant for the first time when the board has never looked at them or considered them would be something that it cannot do.
Can we add?
Thank you. No, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Judge Meredith?
Anything? I'm done for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Horstman?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. If the court were to find the duty to assist was violated, remanding this case is still unnecessary because the court can see that appellant is not prejudiced. First, the secretary asks that the court grant the secretary's motion to amend the RBA in order to add records constructively within the board's possession. Second, the court can determine that there's no debate that appellant did not suffer any harm due to the exclusion of these records in the board's discussion, and appellant has not met their burden on appeal. As an initial matter, Secretary urges the court to grant its motion to amend the RBA because the VISTA records were in constructive possession of the board. The original RBA references private treatment records that were scanned into VISTA. Even if the court found that VA had a duty to assist appellant in associating these records with his claims file, the records were, as just conceded by counsel, within the board's constructive possession. Because the RBA was accepted with these excluded records and the records were brought to the secretary's attention after the Rule 10 period, the court can now only review the records by finding they were within the board's constructive possession. The Federal Circuit recently confirmed in USBO that the court may consider records within the board's constructive possession. Citing to Lange, the federal court explained, in keeping with its appellate review of board and VA determinations, the veteran court may, under certain circumstances, consider documents that were not literally before an examiner to be constructively part of the claimant's record. The Federal Circuit then cited to Bell, finding that where a dispute arises before this court as to the content of the record that was before the board, these documents are constructively part of the record before the court if the evidence at issue is within the secretary's control and could reasonably be expected to be a part of the record before the secretary and the board. Finally, the Federal Circuit stated in USBO, and it touched on the interplay between VA's duty to assist and the constructive possession doctrine, explaining that, quote, where the VA has breached this duty by omitting from the record documents within its control that could reasonably be expected to be a part of the veteran's claim, the constructive possession doctrine provides a remedy. This position is also consistent with Rule 10 of the court's Rules of Practice and Procedure. Paragraph A of Rule 10 requires a copy of all materials that were contained in the claims file on the date of the board decision, and it requires a copy of any other material from the record before the secretary and the board relevant to the board decision on appeal. Appellant has argued these records are potentially relevant, and since these records were in constructive possession of the secretary and the board prior to the board decision, under Rule 10 and under USBO, it must be included in the RBA. After finding that the records were within the board's constructive possession, the court can make the legal determination that appellant has not met their burden on appeal to demonstrate prejudicial error. And it is undebatable that appellant was not prejudiced by the board's lack of discussion of these records. The secretary acknowledges the limitation placed on judicial review of board decisions, but there are exceptions to the record rule. In USBO, the Federal Circuit rejected the argument that Section 7252 prohibits the Veterans Court from considering records constructively before the board because the constructive possession doctrine is an exception to the record rule. The Federal Circuit stated, Veterans Court must also review board and VA determinations for abuse of discretion and arbitrary and capricious decision-making, including whether the board or VA entirely failed to consider an important aspect of the problem. Additionally, the Federal Circuit explained that where the administrative record is insufficient to permit meaningful judicial review, the reviewing court may consider extra record evidence. Also, the Federal Circuit in Tadlock, which was just issued this month, dealt with the court's ability to make findings when accounting for prejudicial error. And the Federal Circuit stated, quote, the Veterans Court may affirm on a ground not considered by the board and VA if it's clear that the factual basis for such conclusion is not open to debate and the board on remand could not have reached any other determination on that issue. Additionally, Tadlock reaffirmed that prejudicial error inquiry is not limited to the facts as found by the board, but rather requires the Veterans Court to review the record of proceedings before the secretary and the board. Under Tadlock, the court has the authority to find that the constructively possessed VISTA records, despite the fact that the court may find that they should have been included in the original RBA under the duty to assist, are undebatably irrelevant to an increased rating claim for PTSD. And it's undebatable that the board would reach the same conclusion if it was remanded. Appellant argues in his opening brief that treatment for a suspected stroke reasonably could be expected to include psychological evaluations, which would include updated information on the severity of the PTSD symptoms. However, when reviewing the records, the court can see that appellant's treatment records include no such psychological evaluations, and there's nothing at all related to PTSD. This would include both the January 2018 hospital records and the January 2015 hospital record, which predated the period on appeal. And I do want to touch base on appellant's contention about the distorted records from May 2018. These records that are distorted in the that are attached to our motion and brief are actually duplicates of records that are already contained in the RBA. And I can provide your honors with those RBA sites if you guys would like. And at the same time, I could also file an amended ROBE to include these duplicates that are already in the RBA. But appellant has not presented any argument that these records actually contain anything related to PTSD in either of their briefs. And that's their burden on appeal. The other VISTA records that were attached to the secretary's motion to amend, these were purely.
My apologies.
No worries. The other VISTA records that were included in the secretary's motion to amend were administrative notes. They were labeled B basis. These weren't treatment, and they just involved hospital billing, and it was appellant applying for a fee basis. And so these aren't related at all to PTSD. The secretary is not asking the court here to weigh the evidence. Instead, we're asking the court to find that this evidence is undebatably irrelevant to the issue on appeal, that it's undebatable that remand in this instance would be futile, and to make the legal determination that appellant has not met their burden on appeal to demonstrate prejudicial error. As the Federal Circuit stated in Tadlock, to obviate the necessary remands and unnecessary protracted proceedings, Congress, while otherwise broadly supporting the rights of veterans, statutorily mandated consideration of prejudicial error in the determination of appeals before the Veterans Court. And there's nothing in Tadlock that goes against what the Supreme Court held in Sanders. So with the benefit of seeing these records, the court can determine that remanding for the board to discuss these records would be unnecessary because it is undebatable that they in no way can substantiate appellant's claim for 100% PTSD rating and that appellant has not met his burden on appeal. If there are no questions, Your Honors, the secretary would ask that the court affirm. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I wanted to start with asking you about the appellant's alternate argument about the heightened duty to assist due to the missing claims file. First of all, does the secretary concede that VA at some point lost the appellant's claims file?
Yes, Your Honor. At some point in time, appellant's claims file was lost. It was records from, I believe, 2013 through 2017.
So the board in the decision on appeal here, I don't believe mentions that the claims file was lost and doesn't make any findings as to whether the file was appropriately recreated, whether there are still any documents missing, or whether in general the duty to assist had been satisfied. Does the board have some obligation to do that when the claims file, when there's evidence that the claims file has at some point been lost, to assure the veteran and this court that all of the documents have, or all efforts have been made to reacquire all of the documents that were lost?
Your Honor, in this case, I believe not, because in this case, it doesn't appear that there are any missing records now. The September 2017 deferred rating decision instructed the RO to upload all of appellant's records from the Philadelphia VAMC from 2013 through 2017, and additional Altoona VAMC records beginning in August 2017. And all of these records are now in the claims file. Appellant hasn't pointed to anything that would be missing. At this point, it doesn't appear that there are any missing records, and we believe it would be appellant's burden now to demonstrate that there is something missing, and they just haven't done that. They haven't presented that argument.
Is VA not in a better position than the appellant to determine whether records that VA possessed and then lost, whether they've all been reacquired? Why would VA not be in the best position to make that determination rather than the appellant?
Your Honor, while VA would be in a better position to state that, it does not appear that there are any missing records in at all. It appears that all the claims file was completely rebuilt based on all of these VA records now being uploaded. And this even includes appellant's November 2015 VA examination, which was the basis for 70% rating.
None of that, though, is mentioned in the board decision that's before us for review.
Your Honor, that's correct. But even if there was a duty to assist violation with the board or reasons or basis error with the board not discussing that in particular, appellant, it's still appellant's burden to demonstrate prejudice in this error, in this case. And despite the fact that they've argued this, they have not demonstrated anything in their opening brief or the reply brief that there are any missing records or that there's any prejudice due to any potential missing records. Appellant has not stated that there's anything indicating a worsening of symptoms. It's all based purely on hypotheticals. There might be something demonstrating that he has a worsening of symptoms, but without appellant actually stating that, you know, my symptoms have gotten worse, or I reported to a physician that my symptoms have gotten worse, they don't meet their burden to demonstrate prejudicial error.
Thank you.
Yes. That you had, the secretary had submitted a motion to supplement, then submitted a motion to a motion to amend, but you withdrew the motion to supplement. What's the difference between the two motions?
Your Honor, the reason why we withdrew the original motion was because it hadn't been ruled on at the time, and our briefing deadline was coming up. And since that motion, we thought that because we combined the motion to amend with a motion for leave, that it was a combined motion, and that might have been in violation of the court's rules. So that's why we withdrew that motion and refiled. But there's no difference between the word supplement and amend, that how we use that.
Thank you. Any further questions, Judge Meredith?
No, thank you.
Judge Valerie?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horseman.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
You're welcome. Ms. Hendricks?
Thank you, Your Honor. So a few points that I wanted to talk about based on what the secretary said. So first he uses Bell to argue that the records, that if they're constructively possessed by the board, that they should be made part of the record before the court. But I think that there's a few distinctions between VISTA scan documents in VISTA and what happened in Bell. The first being that in Bell, that was a paper file. And the second is that that decision predated Sullivan and Jones, which said that there's no relevancy requirement to obtain VA treatment records, and which would include authorized treatment by VA. And second, in that case, it wasn't a situation where the secretary purposely kept those records from the board. You know, to use that case in this instance would be unfair to the veteran, which I think I talked about before. I guess the other point is that the argument that the secretary can cure basically a duty to assist error before the board by simply appending records to his brief now, that would create a world in which the agency would be largely excused from developing the record to the optimum. Congress has passed, a statute, there's a regulatory obligation, but the secretary's position is that, we should basically overrule what Congress intended, which is that the board has a duty to assist before it to obtain these records to develop the record to the optimum. And his position is also saying that, veterans would then have to collect their own records and present them in court to prove error, which would again eviscerate the agency's duty to assist in obtaining records. The cases that he cites to Tadlock and Eusebio, you know, it mandates that the Veterans Court take due account of the rule of prejudicial error, but that doesn't create an excuse. It doesn't say you can excuse VA from assisting veterans in developing the record to the optimum. And then in terms of the secretary's arguments about the heightened duty to assist for the contemporaneous examination, I think it was, as we argued in our reply brief, for the secretary to now say, when the board never recognized or said anything about, you know, that the examination was in November 2015, that between 2015 and 2017, the claims file was lost. You know, there is that deferred rating decision that does seem to indicate that there was something missing, which means there could be other things missing. The board never talked about that at all. So as I believe we pointed out in our reply brief, that is all post hoc rationalization, which the secretary cannot do. That would have to be remanded to the board for them to determine in the first instance.
Any questions for counsel, Judge Meredith?
No, thank you.
Judge Falvey?
I do not, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Hendricks, then you have nothing further to say to the court?
No, just to conclude, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So because the secretary is asking that the court make an initial factual finding that the VA treatment records he appended to his brief are not relevant, despite the fact that the board never saw these records and had an undisputable duty to assist obligation to obtain them, we ask the court to vacate the portions of the October 22nd, 2018 board decision denying entitlement to a PTSD rating higher than 70% and to remand the matter for re-adjudication. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel. The case will be submitted and with the thanks of the court.
And this court is in recess.